Welcome to The Commercial Disco, a voyage of commercial discovery. This episode is proudly brought to you by CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency and Innovation Catalyst. Explore the commercialization of great ideas across deep tech and science. Immerse yourself in conversations with the ambitious minds shaping Australia's unique innovation landscape. Discover their insights into what's needed to bring these remarkable ideas to life.
Hello and welcome to The Commercial Disco. I'm James Riley, Editorial Director at innovationaus.com. The Commercial Disco is brought to you in partnership with the National Science Agency, CSIRO. And today I'm talking to Professor Joanna Weaver, who is the Executive Director of the Tech Policy Design Centre at the Australian National University. Can we call you the founder as well?
You can call me a founder, indeed.
All right, there we go. Okay, founder of the Tech Policy Design Centre at the ANU. So let's start with the basics, all right? What is the Tech Policy Design Centre and why did Australia need one?
All right. Well, look, our mission is to shape technology for the benefit of humanity. And really, the rationale for it, before I came back to Australia and established the Design Centre, I was working with governments all around the world. So I was Australia's chief cyber negotiator. And in that role, I was literally had conversations with, I think, nearly every government in the world, including some really interesting ones like Iran and DPRK and Russia and China, but also all of our like-minded close partners. And it was so evident to me that so many countries are grappling with how to regulate technology, but there wasn't really any research institutions looking at best practice. How do we actually do this and get good outcomes for our economies and for our people? And that's essentially why I came back and founded the Tech Policy Design Centre.
All right, let's take one step further back. Your history, I think, just from knowing you personally, I know that you started as a graduate into the DFAT program, but you've done all sorts of things since then. Talk me through how that DFAT foreign affairs experience plays into what you're doing now.
So much. So I was a litigator before I joined DFAT, and I joined DFAT as a generalist diplomat, and then I actually left DFAT and joined again after having specialized in cyber policy. And I think both your training as a lawyer, but also your training as a diplomat teaches you to do is bring together groups of people who don't necessarily agree with each other, try and find common ground and to be able to move forward incrementally. And when you're talking about tech regulation or tech policy, there are so many diverse groups. There's such a lack of trust between government and industry. There's a fear of capture, which in some instances is an appropriate fear, in other instances, it's not. And so the relationships really need some work. And so I think those skills that we bring and training that I had through DFAT and as a lawyer are really useful. And then there's just the breadth and the understanding of Australia's pretty unique place. So I spent 5 years working with Australia's inaugural ambassador for cyber affairs, and it gives you a perspective on Australia's role in tech regulation that we perhaps don't otherwise have. And I think politicians often overestimate Australia's power when it comes to regulating tech. But by the same token, policymakers and the average punter on the street probably underestimate the potential impact that we can have. And particularly countries that are looking to us and watching what we're doing and copying us. And so there's a real power in being aware of the role that Australia plays and the impact that that's having shaping the tech ecosystem more broadly.
So I'm kind of interested just in the operational aspects of the Tech Policy Design Centre. It does research, obviously. So there is a research component to it, but it's also a teaching facility. Is that right? So firstly, talk to me about areas of research and then talk to me about what does a student look like? What kind of a person is coming through a program that you've designed?
I think ultimately what we do at the Tech Policy Design Centre is bring together those diverse actors, so government, industry and civil society. So everything we do, whether it's research, engagement or education, and those are the three areas of work that we do, it's about bringing people together, bringing those diverse perspectives and then providing a best practice outcome that is an independent product at the end. Probably the best example of the research we do is Tech Policy Design, a Tech Policy Atlas. People Google this, you can find it online. It's a repository of different attempts globally to regulate technology. And when I say a repository. I mean, it's very extensive. We have 187 jurisdictions included in there. We have 30 different policy types, everything from privacy to cybersecurity to visas and research and design incentives. And the point of pulling that all together as a research task was because if we're talking about best practice, how do you actually find this stuff, right? Every government organizes itself differently. Stuff is on obscure websites. Unless you know the governments, it's hard to find the information. And if we're not actually learning from each other, then we're not going to be able to regulate the most effectively. And so that repository is open source and available. Our team update it almost daily, but certainly every week. And that's an example of research work that we do. And we're now building an entire research program on top of the Atlas. So the Atlas is just a tool. And now we're looking at research programs, so particular areas of research to do deep dives down in. The education program, this is new. We're designing Australia's first ever tech policy curriculum. And that's because everyone working in this field has kind of learned on the job, myself included. And so this is so important to everything that we do across our economy, across our society. Every policymaker is a tech policymaker, whether they know it or not. And yet we don't actually teach our policymakers and give them the skills to understand, to skill them to be able to do this well. So our ideal student is basically people working in the public service on these issues already, but also people working in industry, because by the same token, industry needs to better understand government and how government works. And so the idea is that we bring together the cohorts of students, of public servants, of people from industry, whether they're in government affairs or working in legal teams or the likes, and work together and learn from each other, including productive discomfort. Sometimes in our courses, the people from the public service might be more comfortable with particular elements of it. Industry might be more comfortable with other elements of it. And learning and working together, and whilst doing the education program, also building a community of people that have a longer term benefit for us as well. And then the final pillar of our work is engagement. And an example of that is we support the Parliamentary Friends of Technology Policy. And this is a group that is bipartisan, crossbench. So we have two independents, Greens, Liberals and Labour, co-chairs, five co-chairs, don't recommend that for anyone. And we bring the parliamentarians together to talk about tech policy issues. So recently we held a hypotheticals on digital identity. We've done one on AI for productivity. So those are the three pillars: research, education, and engagement. And all of it is designed to uplift capacity so that we get better tech policy and tech regulation at the end.
This is not a philosophical question, but you said you're looking domestically and looking at building the best regulatory environment as you can to have the most productive economy and society that we can using technology. But you're also very deeply engaged in the international aspect of this. So philosophically, does that make you a globalist in relation to this stuff? I mean, I suppose we all live in the world, so we're all globalists, but there are connotations around that with tech, with technology kind of becoming supranational. I mean, is there a philosophical bent to the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's in our mission to shape technology for the benefit of humanity. In terms of the domestic and international focus, I don't think any country in the world can look at its domestic regulation of technology without an eye to what's going on internationally. Now, all of us might be focusing on what's going on internationally in different places, and we might prioritize or emphasize different countries. But technology is global. The platforms that we're using is global, and therefore our approach to regulating it must at least take that into account. I'm certainly not someone who thinks that we will end up with a harmonized global regulatory framework. I think that's never going to happen. But we do need to have interoperability if we're going to get all of the benefits that there are, and if we're going to protect from the harms. And I think people hear the word regulation and they think this is something that's going to constrain, but actually regulation also enables. It's a positive, right? Think of visa regulations. Think of share buyback legislation. If we get the regulatory settings right, it's a positive for Australian businesses and for Australian industry and for the companies that are building Australian tech and want to export it. So it's also reframing it as a positive, not just a negative.
Okay. Well, as you said earlier, tech policy really is a horizontal thing. It pretty much touches everything. So there's no shortages of areas to kind of delve into quite deeply. So I'm going to say AI, the e-safety commissioner, the privacy, there is an endless stream of issues. So where do you find that you're spending most of your time? Or are you trying to develop frameworks that can be applied to different platform areas, if you like?
Yeah, look, I think as a starting point, we look at what actually is best practice in the craft of designing tech regulation, because for some reason, there's still this perception that tech regulation is special, that it's in this category of its own, despite the fact that we actually regulate many other complex industries. It's like, oh no, the tech sector is different. The tech sector is special. So I think the first thing is actually just getting a really clear understanding of baseline best practice. And we've done that through, for example, our tech policy design kit, tech policy process and principles, but also looking to do deep dives in particular areas. So this year, areas that we'll be focusing on, and this won't be a surprise to anybody, cybersecurity, privacy, digital identity, artificial intelligence. These are some of the areas that the team are focusing on and doing work. We're also doing a big piece of work around telecommunications resilience as well. And also the work on maintaining the tech policy atlas, which is because this field is evolving so quickly, making sure that we're keeping that up to date as a resource is always important as well.
Okay. The Albanese government in the past couple of years has spent a lot of time on its responsible AI policies, or kind of digging deep into AI and trying to understand how responsible AI policies might be put around that. So just talk me through that. It seems like a long time to be developing policy in an area that's moving so fast. When you're looking at something like AI, which touches on all industries and, you know, is that kind of general tech. So how do you design policy to regulate something that has changed by the time you get a framework together?
First of all, I'll just pick up on something that you said in your question, which is AI is a general purpose tech, right? And one of the things that I have really observed is this evolution in the use of the word AI when a lot of the time people mean tech, and we're not being specific about what type of tech. So the answer to your question is it depends what type of AI, and bringing that nuance to the conversation. There's no one size fits all. I think how do we regulate for a technology that's so quickly evolving is that we go back to first principles as a starting point, and then we do deep dives into the areas that are unique. What do I mean by go back to first principles? Well, actually, most of the existing frameworks that we have, right, around things like privacy, security, director's duties, liability, all of these types of things actually provide pretty robust frameworks for the regulation of artificial intelligence already. So artificial intelligence is already regulated, and the government, and I talk about this all the time and commend them for this, is they were really clear in the issues paper that they put out late last year saying that the existing legal frameworks apply. Therefore, you have a really strong starting point, and then you need to look at, okay, what are the gaps that we need to fill in terms of specific types of technology? And here I'm thinking the frontier AI, right at the frontier of the tech development, which maybe isn't of so much of an importance for Australia to be regulating because we don't actually have companies that are operating at that very frontier. And then when we're looking at filling the gaps, it's looking at it from a technology perspective, but also from an industry-specific perspective. So it may be that if we're looking at this in the financial sector, use of artificial intelligence in the financial sector may have some specific characteristics that need to be considered. But to circle back on something I said earlier, this is not unique. This is actually how regulation happens across the economy. You have general purpose laws that exist and apply to everything. You may look at particular types of technologies in different industries. If you think about WH&S laws, for example, and we put specific protections around particular types of technology, and then we might say, okay, well, actually the mining sector needs to have additional regulation. So it's not reinventing the wheel in doing this. And if we make sure that we have these strong and robust principles-based tech-neutral frameworks, then we can actually keep pace with technology. And I think liability is an excellent example of that.
Okay, let me ask you about something you mentioned earlier. You were saying politicians maybe overstate the influence that Australia can have on shaping policy, and the average punter probably underestimates it. So where we do seem to have particular influence, we seem to have either an activist regulator or someone who, for many reasons, is powerful in their particular domain. So right now, you would look at Julian and Grant and the Office of the Safety Commissioner, and you would say, she's doing things in Australia that have potentially global implications, but it's happening from here, but it doesn't happen in other areas. So where do we pick our marks, or do we just go where we have particular expertise? How do those things shape? You know, when we talk about an Australian regulator taking on multiple very large corporations, if you can talk to that kind of power imbalance, how do we push through with these things?
I think you're absolutely right. And there's a perception that government and the public service is this sort of one entity. And so much of what happens within government is driven by personalities. And Julie Imaan Grant is an excellent example of someone who is world leading in what she's doing, because she's got the skills and a team sitting behind her. And I think this is what I mean by we often underestimate as well, in the sense that if Australia says this is an area we're going to prioritise, this is an area we're going to give resources to, then we have big impact. And I personally have witnessed that in the cyber negotiations that I was doing, where Australia played an influential role internationally in getting an agreement on the application of the laws of war to cyberspace. Now, stick with me, but it's a tangential connection, but it's another example of where if we invest, we are respected and listened to internationally, because we aren't a great power, right? We aren't known as one of the center points of, you know, from Silicon Valley or coming out of China. And so many other countries go, oh, we're a bit like Australia. That makes sense what Australia is doing, and we could actually do it. Whereas I think a lot of other countries, when they look at what the EU might do, they might admire it, they might want to do it, but they feel that they don't have the heft to be able to put behind it. And so I think recognizing that dynamic for Australia and choosing where we have a unique value add, where there's a need and incentive, you know, for example, where do we have industry that is at the forefront and cutting edge, and what can we be doing to shape the international regulatory environment where Australia has a competitive advantage, not just holus bolus, let's direct our resources. You know, quantum computing comes to mind, or quantum more generally, not just computing. So I think being focused in our efforts is really important, but also recognizing the role we play, not just in developing the tech, but also diffusing the tech. So how do we actually uptake this tech? How do we make sure we're using the tech, embedding it in our economies, but doing so in a way that supports our societies in the transition? This is something that every country is looking and struggling with how to do this. And I think that's a real area of competitive advantage for Australia, and something we should be leaning into more.
Okay, I'm talking to Johanna Weaver, the Executive Director and Founder at the Tech Policy Design Centre at the Australian National University. So I could have dug in a little bit more on the Julian and Grant stuff, because I find it so fascinating. And it goes to your point that we have laws around child exploitation, terror-related information, those kinds of things. But we must move on. I want to ask you about some of the multilateral forums and how Australia fits into those things. Like, obviously, Australia is part of all sorts of organisations that tangentially or directly influences tech policy. The one I'm going to ask you about is the Quad. This is a really interesting forum anyway, right? But Japan, US, Australia, India. Now, I would say that Australian business is very much intertwined with India in the information technology field. There's lots of outsourcing, all sorts of connections in there. And in the Quad, India kind of stands alone within that partnership. So the recent Russian election, there were just a very tiny handful of countries that congratulated Vladimir Putin on his re-election, and India was one of those countries. So how do we have Australia intertwined with a country like India, involved in a Quad? It's a geostrategic organization, very much reliant on the technology and the technology policies that enable the movement of information, all of those things. How do you then separate out tech policy that kind of underpins an Australia-US relationship, but also manages to take in a relationship with a country like India, who we love and are our friends, but are standoffish?
Look, I think just as a starting point, understanding why we engage internationally at all is important. So much of what happens at home domestically, as we have innovators and companies working on these things, the technology standards that are set internationally or the laws and rules that are set internationally shape how that technology can be built and how that technology can be exported. So, you know, it's a bit glib, but I always say, if you control the standards, you control the tech. And if you control the tech, you control the world. Now, the only way we can influence what's happening internationally is by harnessing partnerships. Australia can't shape international agreements by ourselves. We have to use partners. And part of the value of the Quad relationship is our differences. So we shouldn't minimize the fact that Australia and India, Japan and the US don't always agree on everything, right? We should be very open about that, because that makes when we do agree all the more valuable and forceful in international negotiations on these things like tech standards or tech law and regulation. So again, this is something I've witnessed myself. If Australia goes in and advocates for something, people will think we're coming in with a particular agenda, often thinking that we're closely aligned with the US, even if that may not always be the case. If India goes in and negotiates for something, they'll think, oh, question mark about human rights. If Australia and India walk into a room and negotiate for something, people are like, oh, that's interesting, and are much more likely to have a whole bunch more countries come in and join the whatever it is that we're advocating for on that particular issue. I think what's interesting about the Quad, it's obviously a very important relationship in terms of geostrategically balancing many of the different dynamics globally. What I think is not spoken about or appreciated often is the tension between AUKUS and Quad. So, for example, as a result of AUKUS, we've passed late last year legislation that in many instances prohibits the export of particular types of technologies to countries outside of the AUKUS agreement. Well, how does that fit if you're Japan or if you're India? So there is a lot of interplay between all of these different international agreements that we have, and it's a constant balancing act between priorities. But I really come back to where I started, which is just because we're different, that's actually the value of these agreements, and being honest and frank about those differences and calling each other out when we need to.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up AUKUS, and we probably could spend another hour on that.
It's just a teaser on all the subjects that we can't talk about because we don't have time.
We don't have that hour, but just very quickly, I'm interested in that because there will be instances of Australian technology companies that have a kind of a top tier, for want of a better word, technology that's governed by defence controls that are potentially harmed by the AUKUS arrangements that make it difficult to share tech or share information related to that tech with countries outside of AUKUS.
Yeah, look, that's definitely one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is there's enormous benefit and financial gain to be had by being part of the AUKUS agreement. And I think that's the trade-off. We're saying, actually, if you're developing this tech, AUKUS is going to buy it. And so there's your market. Don't sell it to someone else. We're going to buy it. If we were saying don't sell it to anyone else and you don't have a market, then it would be causing the damage you're talking about. And there definitely are differing perspectives across industry, and Innovation Oz has written on this subject, I know, canvassing some of those different perspectives.
All right, we are definitely going to have to leave it there. Johanna Weaver from the Tech Policy Design Centre, thank you very much for being on the Commercial Disco.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Commercial Disco podcast, proudly brought to you by CSIRO. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you heard us. For the latest on tech, innovation, and public policy, visit innovationoz.com. And stay connected with us on social media to ask questions or suggest future guests. Until next time, this is the Commercial Disco wishing you an inspired week ahead.